Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Augusta Macellari, and Rob Bound.
On today's show, we'll be meeting Sir David Spiegelhalter, Chair of Cambridge University's Winton Centre for Risk and Evidence Communication, who will be telling us why a healthy understanding of stats is an essential component in any newshound's toolkit.
Then we'll be finding out where traditional folky disciplines meet the cutting edge of contemporary composition as we hear from poet Will Burns and composer and producer Hannah Peel.
And we'll be taking a look back at one of the most entertaining art movements you've never heard of as we learn all about the Chicago Imagists from the curators of a new show of their work.
That's all coming up. Plus, Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco will be joining us live from Milan to unpack a week of chic, chic style at Salone del Mobile, the world's best design fair. And, of course, we'll enjoy some music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Rob, it's lovely to be here.
Aug, it's lovely to be here as well. How's this week been for you?
It's been all right, you know. We've been missing a lot of the M24 team. They've been off at Salone del Mobile.
It's been good stuff. It's felt in London like spring has been springing.
Yes.
There's been a bit of sunbathing in the Monocle Garden.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? Monocle Garden is not a euphemism for something. It does exist, ladies and gentlemen. You can walk in the corner, in the nook between Manchester Street and Dorset Streets and find us with our sun, at least our sun, our faces in the sun.
Tops
right?
off.
That comes later.
That's more of a high summer.
Indeed, it is.
I've just been transfixed by the news that Julian Assange has finally been arrested 7 years after disappearing up the back door of the Ecuadorian embassy.
Apparently, he's been thrown out. He was thrown out because he was mean to his cat.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a good one, isn't it?
Plenty from us. Shall we see what Fernando has to say live from Salone? Fernando Augusto Pacheco?
To be honest, actually, I'm feeling quite Italian already after a whole week here in Milano.
What have you been breakfasting on, Fernando? Have you been going with the full force of the Milan power breakfast? Have you been kept standing
yes,
by
when
espresso?
It comes to breakfast, actually, I'm much closer to Italians than the British, actually, because, you know, they like a good, simple cake for breakfast, and so do I. So, yes, I've been having lots of cake in the morning and some good tortelloni as well for lunch and more great pasta for dinner. So, yes, I've been eating well, guys, I have to say. Sorry, I don't want to make you jealous or anything, but, you know.
It's all right. Tesco sandwiches are my favourite food, so keep your ravioli. Faye, tell us how it's been, because you've been there, as you say, all week. Another year has passed. We've been getting some great broadcasts out of Salone here on Monocle 24. What, for you, have been the highlights of the week?
Well, I've got to be honest, this is my first Salone. I realize how big of an event it is. There's more than 500,000 of people coming to Milano for this. And, you know, of course, you have the Fiera where the Salone del Mobile is, you know, the fair, which is quite, you know, commercial. You know, there's a lot of kind of journalists and buyers. But to be honest, the whole city kind of breathe this fair. And, you know, one of our colleagues that we interviewed, Christoph Amen from Zeit magazine, he said, you come to Milano in this week not just to see, you know, the latest on furniture, but actually to meet your friends, you know, to meet, you know, here there are architects, you know, from Brazil, from Italy, from China, Russia, from literally everywhere. It's quite good fun in that sense. Although I have to say there's so many events, so it can be a bit chaotic. You know, where should I go next? You know, so you have to be very choosy in which event you decide to go or who you interview, because it is quite massive, actually.
Faye, I've been to Milan a few times for Fashion Week and had enjoyed some pretty decent quality parties there. I'm expecting that the design fraternity is no less rock and roll after hours. What have you been up to in the evenings?
Oh, they're quite rock and roll here, and even our colleagues here at Monaco 24, some more than others, they've been enjoying a few kind of Negronis and all sorts of other cocktails as well. I have to say, I've been a good boy, because, you know, I like to have perhaps maximum three cocktails and have a quite relaxed evening, but everybody seems to go to Barbasso these days. Huh? It's kind of the big point here in Milano, and it's quite small as well. I was expecting something bigger, but, you know, it's quite charming, and we had some good weather, even though kind of now it's a little bit chillier now, I have to say, but yeah, the sun did come up, and it looks like Milano in the summer in a way, but yeah, lots of good parties here.
You also are renowned in these offices and far and wide for having a wonderful broadcasting wardrobe. Fernando. We know when it's summer. We missed you this week, in fact, because the spring has started to spring in London, as I was just saying to Org, and you'd have been resplendent, I'm sure, in some fine colours. What have you been sporting behind the mic?
Well, to be honest, yes. As you know, I do like a bit of colour, but to be honest, the things I wear here in Milano, I mean, everyone like a bit of color here, especially the older ladies, which I appreciate very much their fashion sense, the big hair, the extreme coat, something that perhaps you don't see that much in London. But for example, I did bring new pieces here, like a lime green corduroy shirt that I have, and I have the same model but in acid pink. I think it worked quite well for Salone del Mobile, in my opinion. I don't know, maybe you disagree.
Faye, finally, you've been there, you've seen some of the best design going. Let's imagine for one second that budget was no issue. You had a bottomless wallet.
Oh, God. That's a very difficult question. But I spoke to Marva Griffin-Wilshire. She's the president of Salone Satelliti, which is kind of the, where young designers are. And I saw quite a lot of good chairs there. And, I think there's a lot of interesting work there, even by fellow Brazilians as well. So perhaps I'll buy some Brazilian furniture here. There's some lovely chairs, kind of slightly mid-century style, but with slightly more interesting at times. So I'll probably get that. I don't know the price, but,
Yeah, it's one extra bag in the hold for Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Fernando, we've missed you in the office. I'm glad you've had a wonderful week in Milan. Safe travels back. That was Fernando Augusto Pacheco. You are listening to The Monocle Weekly. In a moment, we'll be hearing from David Spiegelhalter talking about the importance and the art of statistics.
Now, we're all familiar with the sinking feeling we get when we open the paper, only to discover that our favourite snack has been determined to increase our risk of death substantially. Hula hoops increase colon cancer by 99%, a headline might scream. But how reliable are these numbers?
Sir David Spiegelhalter has spent his career in the field of statistics. In the past, his research and expertise has been called upon by various public inquiries, including into the serial killer Harold Shipman. But for the past few years, he's been concerned with the public understanding of statistics and risk.
While David's previous books have used statistics variously through the lenses of sex, danger and death, his latest, The Art of Statistics, takes a wider look at the discipline, laying out some of the fundamental principles that underpin it. The better that we numerically illiterate might be able to read past those fear-mongering headlines to meaningfully grasp the meaning behind the numbers. Earlier, I caught up with David and began by asking why now was the time for this broad approach.
Oh, I think it's because I'm old and I wanted to do something that encompasses everything I've learned in my entire life, which is there's a bit of truth in that, in fact, because, I love stats. I've just finished being president of the Royal Statistical Society. I'm really proud to be a statistician. And I wanted to sort of explore the whole breadth of the subject, rather than focusing on just risk or health or sex or anything like that, because it is such a broad subject, and I think it's an incredibly important time for people to grasp some basic principles. I mean, it's a wonderful time for data and statistics, and for many reasons. First of all, of course, the rise of data science. There's so much data available. There's so many people going into data analytics, and it's part of technology, even AI, machine learning, and so on, and that's great. There's also, and I have to say this is almost a boon for statisticians, a rise in misinformation, fake news, whatever you want to call it, in terms of sort of spurious claims, apparently based on facts. And I spent my time trying to debunk a lot of those things. But what is even more important is that actually people are aware of some, questions to ask and tricks you can use to try to identify, what might be behind a claim being made. Well, and so I think this is very important. So for all those reasons, I was very pleased to have the opportunity to write essentially an introductory book. I don't know. I grew up in the time when pelicans were very popular, these blue-backed. Every bookshelf has had your blue-backed books on anarchism and things like that. I've still got them, I think. And they've been out of print for a while, but they've started this new series. And so I really like this idea of autodidact books, people who want to teach themselves about a subject in a fairly non-technical way. And so I've written it without any maths, essentially. So it's usually if people do stats, I'm sure most people who do a stats course don't like it. I got to be honest about it. Most people don't like it. And I teach them, and it breaks my heart. But there is a new way of teaching stats now that this book exemplifies, and that's one in which it almost, the structure is flipped. Instead of starting with the maths and the probability theory and sampling distribution of the sample mean and all this kind of stuff in the way it's traditionally taught and actually puts people off, and then leads to, oh, the formula for various statistics and tests and estimates. And by this time, everyone's really groaning and, you know, wondering. It just looks like a bag of tools. You can just choose the right test and formula to use. And I think this is rightly off-putting. And so the new structure, which the book exemplifies, is one where you start with, essentially, this critical reasoning. It starts with stories about data. It's problem-driven, data being used to answer important questions, and looks at data displays and what can we learn from data? Can we learn what causes what from data? And so on. And you can do all of that without any maths by using ideas.
As you say that, kind of, we live in a time where that need for critical reasoning is itself critical. Public trust has kind of eroded in experts, which maybe is why you have this ascendancy of fake news and statistics as well. I wonder whether, you know, you put that kind of disconnect people feel from expert opinion that has traditionally been backed up with data down to something in a miscommunication at the data technologist end or the journalist end or, you know.
Yeah, all of that. But also, I would dispute about this lack of trust and expertise. The evidence for that is very weak indeed. In fact, the evidence, if you ask about, you know, on trust ratings, scientists, statisticians, and so on, professionals, come up so very high indeed. They're always, nurses are always at the top, and doctors are second. But after that becomes professors and scientists. So it's pretty damn good, and a lot better than journalists and politicians, of course, who are down at the bottom next to estate agents and used car dealers. So although, you know, everyone quotes Michael Gove, but Michael Gove has been unfairly quoted. That's fake news itself, I think, because everyone cuts him off at his sentence when he said everyone has had enough of experts. But actually he went on to say something extremely sensible and with which I agree. He went on to say that the experts people have had enough of are those who make predictions and then don't take any accountability for them when they go wrong. And I think, well, that's fair enough. That is, you know, that's fair enough.
I suppose it is. I mean, that quote taken out of context talks to this sense that there is a disconnect from a kind of technocracy. But maybe that is
anecdotal. Among some, there may be. I mean, there is there's an extremely vocal minority with what you might call as fairly anti-scientific views, mm-hmm. very deeply sceptical views about the claims made about whether it's vaccines or climate change or anything like that, about this expertise, what these scientific institutions are saying. And they are very vocal and they're very prominent on the web. You know, if you Google vaccines, that become their websites and things like that. So they've got themselves very organized, and that's fine. It's not the majority, and any sort of actual survey or anything, it says that people want more evidence-based policy. They want to hear about the evidence. They are interested in evidence, in why something might be the case. They want to know the argument. Oh, because they don't want to be bombarded with just numbers and facts and technicalities, but they want to know why people believe things.
One of the examples that comes up in your book is of a kind of miscommunicated statistic is this idea of the bacon sandwich as a class one carcinogen that's as bad as cigarettes or asbestos or whatever it might be. How do you and have you worked to kind of better communicate that kind of, and could you explain that?
Yeah, that's a wonderful example, which I do drag out quite a lot. Yeah, bacon was classified by the WHO as a class one carcinogen, as you say, in the same category as asbestos and cigarettes. It didn't mean, as was reported by some of the media, that they're as dangerous as cigarettes. What it meant is that the evidence that they were carcinogenic was very strong. And I believe it. Bacon is carcinogenic, full stop. I haven't stopped eating bacon. I start the day with a carcinogen, I say. Well, not every day. Maybe not every day, because then you look down further down the press release from WHO and you see that, okay, here's some numbers. Daily 50 grams of processed meat, which is about a bacon sandwich, increases over someone's lifetime. It's associated with an increased risk of bowel cancer of 18%. To which anyone sensible will say, well, what? A, do I care? Does it matter? What they should ask, and what we're trying to encourage people to ask, is 18% of what? What does it mean? You can't say 18% increase. Well, you know, of what? Well, it turns out, because they didn't tell you, that around about 6 out of 100 people will get bowel cancer during their lifetime, sadly. That's, you know, even if they don't eat any bacon at all, that's what it is. Now, what we're talking, therefore, is an 18% increase of that 6 out of 100, which is pretty well exactly 7 out of 100. So that means, another way of telling the story, and this way of telling the story deliberately tries to make it look as trivial as possible, I recognise that, 100 people are going to have to stuff a great big greasy bacon sandwich down their gob every single day of their lives, and then one of them would be expected to get bowel cancer.
As a consequence of that,
it'll go from 6 to 7. And to which I say, pass the brown sauce. Well, maybe not every day, but occasionally I'm going to treat myself to a bacon sandwich. You know, this is not a terribly risky thing. And that's the way of telling the story. Now, I've deliberately then told the story to make something go from looking frightening, class one carcinogen, to looking rather trivial. And that's the whole point. These numbers don't speak for themselves. We imbue them with meaning, which Nate Silver from 538 said very nicely. That the story, the way in which they're wrapped up, you know, whether it's £350 million per week on the side of a red bus, or whether it's every family will lose £4,000 a year if we leave the EU, which is the claim by the other side, you know, it's the way you tell those stories. Neither of which numbers I believe for one word, 1 minute, but never mind. So that's the way the story is told. And basically, I know I can make numbers look big or small, and a decent journalist should be able to do that as well. And we have to be aware of that.
So when we're thinking about how we understand these sensationalist headlines, which, you know, the reasons for their kind of exaggeration are obvious to most of us, I would have thought, how should a layperson engage with the stats? What are the kind of key things?
You look at chapter 10 of my book. It'll all be made wonderfully clear if you get that far. And I hope you do get that far. I hope people do get that far. It tries to be readable. But by then, I do say, maybe it's leaving it a little bit late in the book, but I want something to be left at the end. Yeah, the sort of 10 questions to ask about a number. And the basic ones, I break them up into three things. First, and it's to do with trustworthiness. This is the business. You know, as a statistician, I should not want to be trusted. That's the wrong thing to try to be. I should try to be trustworthy. That is within my grasp. And this great philosopher, Honora O'Neill, has pointed this out. And it's been taken very seriously by the Office for National Statistics. It's got a new code of conduct. And their number one pillar for official statistics is to be trustworthy, not to be trusted. To be trustworthy, because that is within our control. So you should be asking all the time how trustworthy this evidence is. And first of all, you can ask whether you actually believe the number. Is the number just wrong? You know, can I believe the number? Like the £350 million, that's just wrong. Okay, so that's one thing. So the first thing is the quality of the number itself. Then you should ask, how is this being spun? How is this £350 million, for example, that's obviously being made to look a lot like that. How else could it be spun? Well, I could say, that's £50 million a day. There's 60 million people in the country. That's 80 pence a day. That's a packet of cheese and onion crisps. It doesn't say on the side of the bus, we send a packet of cheese and onion crisps a day to the EU, because that wouldn't sound so great. So we should ask, how is this number being told? What are we being told? And crucially, what are we not being told? What are we not being... That's the most difficult thing of all to ask. And then we should ask whether the interpretation of the number is correct. Have they drawn the right conclusions? Are they saying that watching social media causes mental ill health? Well, yeah, you know, that's the sort of claim. Is that the evidence? Is there evidence for that?
It's really interesting to hear you talk about the difference between trustworthiness and trustedness. One thing that I wondered is, looking towards the future, you know, as you say, a number on its own is kind of neutral, and it's all about the story that we spin around it. As technology, for example, becomes more autonomous, as numbers are put into the service of systems which are kind of self-governing, how do we kind of control the narrative input? Is there a way of looking at controlling that sort of thing so that, you know, a computer program, for example, isn't making decisions which would be dismissed as racist by thinking?
This is so important. This is absolutely crucial and really relates to the fact that this data does not speak for itself. This has been, I think, a misconception within some areas of data science that, because we got masses of data, it'll suddenly tell us the truth, it'll tell us what to do. Well, no, because it all depends on what data you put in. And if the data you put in, you know, for example, in recruitment or anything like that, just has got a gender bias in the past, the computer will have a gender bias in the future. But what is even worse, because the computer looks like it's, you know, without emotion, it's cold, it's calculating, it's going to have more plausibility. There's this thing coming up in AI called overtrust. Is when, you know, because the computer says no, you say, oh, well, the computer says, oh, yes, we believe it. Well, this is really dangerous. We shouldn't trust this stuff necessarily. We mustn't trust a bit of technology just because it looks quite cool. And most of the time, it seems to be not bad. So, again, the trustworthiness of algorithms and claims is completely vital. And because they can have all these biases, all these problems just built into them. And a lot of people are paying a lot of attention to this now. I think there's a role for regulation. You know, I really do. And people are looking at this. I'm not quite sure how, but I wouldn't, you know, say what that regulation should be. But I think before, for example, a bit of AI is let loose in the health service, it's got to tick a lot of boxes, you know, because this is, it's like a drug, you know, and it's got to be properly tested. And just because claims are made about it, particularly when it's, first of all, it might be a commercial product. Secondly, it might be proprietary, so we can't even see what it's doing inside. Well, this is really high-risk stuff, and I think we should be very cautious about just taking these things on board because they look cool and because they claim to be AI.
So always treat statistics and with a critical distance.
Huge skepticism. I mean, I don't believe any number. I never believe a word I'm told about numbers. As soon as someone uses a number, I'm deeply suspicious of them because I feel they're using it as a rhetorical argument, except me, of course.
So David Spiegelhalter there, and his new book, The Art of Statistics, is available now in all good bookshops. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Time for some new music now. We'll be hearing from Hannah Peel and Will Burns in just a moment. But first, from their new album, Chalk Hill Blue, here's Ridgeway.
Ridgeway. It could be the dogs announce your visit. It could be her birds. However it happens, she knows and opens red wine, puts out a bowl. Outside in the fields, the second hay crop cut and turned, a fading day. Dirt that might have been yours to own, an inheritance held in seed.
That was Ridgeway by Hannah Peel and Will Burns. There'll be more from both of them after this. Composer and producer Hannah Peel is known for her pieces that borrow scattered influences, ranging from analogue synth-drenched dance beats to more scores for theatre. She's teamed up with the poet Will Burns for a new album, Chalk Hill Blue.
It combines Will's reflections on the UK's long tradition of storytelling through art forms such as poetry and folk tales, while also trying to understand the nation's current troubled outlook and where it's headed. The words are all set to Hannah Peel's transportive compositions. And earlier, Monocle's Tom Hall spoke to them both to find out more.
Out of doors. We knew sun up as mosquito time, playing itself out in a damp wood and the madness, really, of a dawn chorus being taped. Our field recordings made so we might never lose a thing.
We met at a couple of gigs, actually one show that I'd put on for the Alzheimer's UK for an album, and Christopher Eccleston came and he read a couple of poems, and one of them was Will's, and it was called Out of Doors, which actually made the first track on the album. From that, probably about a year and a half, we kind of toyed with the idea of Will coming to the studio and trying some things out, and eventually we got round to it. And, you know, after a while together making tracks, and they were coming really fast. It wasn't like a kind of record that we planned. It was very much like we did 3 hours together, have a few weeks off, 3 hours together. And by the third time of that, we had enough for a record. And I suppose it just happened, didn't it?
The poems were the group of poems that I was working on in manuscript form at that time anyway, or some of them. And they're all sort of rooted in this area of Buckinghamshire that I live in. And I suppose they try and tell some of the stories of that area. I'm quite interested in the way people occupy their places, what that means, particularly pertinent mode of thinking at the moment. You know, we have so many complicated ideas about this land, what it means to call it our land, who are the people that occupy that hour, as well as the people that occupy that land. And what I hope is that the poems and actually presenting them in this way with music, I hope it kind of complicates people's thinking rather than simplifies it. I hope they don't sort of drift into a kind of easy nostalgia for a kind of rurality that I think is probably quite cartoonish anyway when it's presented in certain senses. It's great that you've picked up that there's, you know, contemporary touches, because I think that's hugely important. You know, we've got to live now, not in an imagined past, I think.
Do you think that in the folk world in general, and that can be an enormous expanse, I know that people think sort of stereotypically of as folk as, like, you know, a guy in a folk club with an acoustic guitar talking about trees or something, but it's folk is really people just talking about their everyday lived experience and not dressing it up as something showbiz, I guess. But I mean, do you think that folk is starting to be understood in a much more immersive, flexible way than it has in maybe past decades?
We live in a time where the way we consume culture has become so kind of boundless. Some of those kind of false binaries or borders between form, between genre, have been kind of eroded by the kind of digital revolution. Things like a word, folk, can become so much more slippery in some senses, and therefore, you know, there's dangers and complications that come with that. But they also can become much more interesting, much more energetic words formally, the way that we might use them. And, I think of things like the Radiophonic Workshop. It seems absolutely obvious to me, living and listening to that work, that it belongs in a sort of folk tradition as much as it belongs in a tradition of electronic music, or, you know, some of those traditions over time, they blur in interesting ways, and also they blur retrospectively. It's never the case that you can dictate what is going to happen to certain aspects of culture from a moment in history when you were living. It always happens in the light of hindsight, I suppose.
Two sisters agreeing under the apple tree that the gathering speed with which everything was being done was just plain wrong.
Hannah, when you were trying to create a musical response to these words, or vice versa, did you have a sort of brief in your mind, or were you just reacting naturally? How did you decide what kind of instruments ended up on this record?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, because actually it came from a place where we had no preconceptions. I had no desire to do any kind of words. Will, who's quite a big fan of country music and guitars and stuff, had no desire to kind of play the instruments that I was surrounded with, which are synthesizers and tape machines and drum machines and all that kind of soundscape stuff. And I say soundscape because what was kind of happening was I would play like maybe a tone in the studio, and a tone as in like a sound, like a synth, kind of rolling synth, like the first track Out of Doors. It kind of starts in the low end and rolls up to the top. And it was that then that triggered Will to look through what he had and said, I've got a poem that will fit this perfectly. It just evolved like that. It wasn't planned. Everything was actually quite freely improvised. And then it wasn't till the very last kind of session that I did with a clarinetist, and who plays the flute and bass clarinet over loads of different things, and he brought it all to the studio, and I scored it all out for him. It's one of those things that was very, I suppose we called it tone poetry in the end, didn't we? Because we were very reactive of each other.
I think it's interesting that you say that. I mean, I'm not sure you sort of decidedly set it out as your stall, but you say that over the project you really had not much interest in contributing lyrics or words to this, and vice versa, you weren't trying to get too involved in the music. But I mean, you do write lyrics, you have sung. What I'm wondering is, have you kind of learned anything from each other? I mean, Hannah, did you learn anything about lyricism from Will, for example?
Yeah. I'm really crap.
Good. Oh, no. Come on. So,
yeah, I've learned that actually I might ask Will to do the lyrics on my next record. I think just going back to that kind of appreciation of each other, and we definitely have to have appreciation of each other's art forms, but it was definitely a thing that we went to the studio and wanted to make something there in the moment, present, and say what was coming out, you know, in our minds and what's going on around us at the moment. So to kind of delve into adjusting each other's things, it just wasn't even on the cards. In fact, I don't even think we didn't even talk about it, did we?
No, I don't think so, which is about what I think is kind of testament to how well the collaborative process worked in the studio. I had this idea that I spoke about a couple of times before where, if it doesn't sound too pompous, if it does, I apologise, but I sort of feel...
We can do pompous.
it's an album of poetry, right? So, I mean, I felt like the collaborative process was really each of us reading the other's work. That's the phrase that I kind of come to like to use, is that I felt like Hannah's music and the gestures she makes in sound were her way of reading the poems, and vice versa. The poems that I felt instinctively reacted to the sounds that she'd come up with first, they were kind of my way of reading those sounds. So in that sense, we were, rather than contributing ideas to each other's form, we were actually kind of reading each other's work through the elements that we were contributing, if you see what I mean. And that's how I feel it built itself, rather than me saying the flute represents such and such a line in the poem. And it was something, I think, slightly more strange than that.
And Hannah, I mean, your music combines quite a lot of disparate kind of sounds, found sounds and analog stuff. Do you ever find yourself not being able to kind of turn off the influence switch, if you know what I mean? Where do you say, no, this record is done, this is finished?
Well, the influence kind of switch. I suppose we live in a world right now, and I've grown up in a very musical world. There isn't really any direct influences, and I suppose in the past, people have found that hard to kind of pigeonhole me and put me in a place that is either, oh, she's a folk artist or she's an electronic artist, but she scores and she does orchestras and stuff. I think there's a general consensus at the moment of things that you can just be. You can just take this melting pot, like a palette of paints, and you can create something. And for me, it's about creating something that speaks and gives an essence of what you're trying to say and communicate. And if that be via woodwind or if that be via the analog synth, then that will be it. I will turn my hand to that and use that. We're in such an amazing time that we can. I mean, obviously, people find it hard to make a living in music, but at the same time, there's just endless possibilities, which is really, really exciting. For albums, though, I do find that it comes with a flow. And you kind of rise on that flow and you take what you need from it and you assess it at the very end. It was like what Will was saying, you know, we didn't know it was an album. It was just a collection of things. When you sit back and have a bit of perspective, then you start to realise this is something and this is what it is and find. It's a bit like being, I suppose, a scientist. You're constantly investigating, digging further, trying to experiment with things till you find something.
And my nights like a praying drunk, smashed and alone and falling asleep, watching YouTube clips of catfish rising and taking pigeons, teal, a dog even, off the water's broken surface. This kind of deep dark is all I will ever earn.
Just coming back to the content and the inspiration for the whole record itself, I mean, we talked about folk and, you know, contemporary versions of it at the beginning of the interview, and you mentioned that people talk about the English folk tradition and you can expand that to perhaps a British folk tradition. Obviously, Britain is made up of very different constituent parts. The whole of the UK is looking at itself and finding out some very, very strange, uncomfortable truths at the moment. I mean, do you think that we're still capable of tapping into one shared sort of identity like that, or do you think it's really breaking up, and maybe in a healthy way, breaking up into a much more sort of scattered, personal led narrative?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I think you're right to suggest that there is some uncomfortable ideas being uncovered and explored in some of the work, and I don't think it's a coincidence that this work is enjoying a high point in terms of people engaging with it at the current kind of socio-political time either. You know, the two things are very linked, I think. I personally wonder whether we ever could have excavated a kind of shared, homogeneous, historical past. I mean, even ideas that we have like Anglo-Saxon would contemporaneously been almost impossible to sort of use that as a catch-all phrase for the disparate tribes and tribal groups that kind of made up the various cultures that occupied the landscape at the time when the word English was evolving, or, you know, the words that England comes from. So I think it's always been stranger, more complicated. I think it's always been about migration and migratory groups. Migration has always been spun in different ways. You know, it's been called invasions, or it's been called, you know, incursions, or, but it's always more complicated than that. Animals move. They almost all, when necessary, and the human animal is no different.
The buildings here, in imitation of the land, safe houses, and here, in anticipation of weather, and here, in regard for the sick. Another round comes round. Pale ale for me, pale and unshaven. There is a common good here after last night, though it has been too hard won.
The wonderful thing about history and culture and traditions, and we talk about the folk tradition, I'm a language obsessive, and I love learning about the Indo-European language family, and part of that is because it both reaffirms the shared heritage that, you know, a group of humans on one bit of the earth have, but also it highlights differences, but differences that are there to be celebrated and loved. And I think it's only through engaging with those questions, uncomfortable as they might be, that we can get to a point where we love each other rather than fear each other, courtesy of, you know, nefarious parties that would rather we feared each other than loved each other.
So you've made this album today. It's kind of translating this, you know, folk tradition in a contemporary way. We would like to hear more albums from you both, but I'm just wondering, if you made a follow-up in 10 years' time, what's that going to sound like?
Let's hope that it sounds like a reaction to a new positivity about a kind of global outlook that is the opposite of globalization, but that embraces the world, but, you know, in a less cynical sense.
Hannah, do you agree?
Oh, yes. They put it very well.
Hannah Peel and Will Burns there in conversation with Monocle's Tom Hall. And their new album, Chalk Hill Blue, is out now on the Rivertones label. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly.
Art now, as we hear from the curators of a new exhibition at South London's Goldsmith CCA Gallery, How Chicago, Imagists, 1960s and 70s.
It's the first UK exhibition in 40 years of a group of artists known as the Chicago Imagists, a group of graduates from the city's art school who use striking graphics, bright colours, wit and humour to great effect.
Working in painting, drawing and printmaking, their work might date back to the 20th century, but wouldn't look out of place in the trendiest of illustration studios today. Earlier, I caught up with the exhibition's curators, Sarah McCrory and Rosie Cooper, and started by asking how this striking show came together.
The exhibition came about because Rosie and I had had several conversations about one of the artists who's in the exhibition, Christina Ramberg, who was in the Glasgow International that I used to run in 2014, and then in the Liverpool Biennial, where Rosie was curator in
2014. Yeah.
So we were mutual fans of her work. I was particularly keen on Jim Nutt and Carl Wersum, and partly that was through my interest in other artists, like Mike Kelly and Jim Shaw. So I'd done a little research around them, and Rosie likewise was looking into them. We made a research trip and hoped to put together an exhibition out of some of that work.
Yeah, and I think for us it feels a really timely exhibition as well, partly because, as you say, the work still feels incredibly fresh. I think if you went to an artist's studio a week ago and they were making exactly the same work, you'd still think it was wild and amazing and want to see more of it. And that freshness is incredible. I think it resonates with things that are happening in contemporary painting at the moment. A lot of painters now are looking back at some of the influences that the Chicago images had at the time as well. So surrealism, for example, which until quite recently was probably a bit of a dirty word, I would say.
A little out of fashion.
Yeah, yeah. It has now returned and people are starting to think about those artists again. And they were also influences on the Chicago Images group. So I think looking at sort of how things return, how, you know, this idea of sort of imaginative figuration, which is something that contemporary painting is looking at quite a lot, is really interesting.
I think as well, there are 14 artists in the exhibition, and I think each of those has their own trajectory and narratives. Mm. And we were just really taken by, as a group of artists who came out of one art school, of the connections between them and how they worked. The work itself is often really kind of poles apart. Mm. There are some artists, of course, who look very closely at each other, but then the difference between perhaps Carl Wersum and Christina Ramberg, in ordinarily they it would be very hard to show them together in a way, and they're drawn together through their biography and through the stories in the work. So, I mean, for us, it's been quite a journey towards understanding what they all did, but then bringing it together again tells a story, you know, that starts roughly in at the beginning of the 60s, and as you've mentioned, is still very prevalent in a lot of people's work, explicitly sometimes, or even just as a kind of subtext.
We can talk about the work, and we can talk about how it looks and about the visual language they use and about the strength of the graphics, but it might be good just for our listeners who maybe haven't heard of the Chicago Imagists, Rosie, if you could, or between you, just maybe explain who as a school, who they were and what they did, because you're right that they're not, there's a sort of stylistic contiguity across all of their work, perhaps, the same interrogation of forms in a similar way, these weird sort of little motifs that crop up, but they're very different artists. So maybe you could just explain a little bit about who they were in the first place.
Sure. So there's 14 artists in the show. One of the other things that's remarkable about them is that there were a lot of women in the movement as well, which is very different to the pop art movement, for example, which was predominantly male. But they were a group of artists who, as Sarah's mentioned, came out of the School of the Art Institute of Chicago during the 1960s. So they weren't all studying together at the same time, but that was the education that they came through. That was the art school that they came through. It was a remarkable art school that was situated within the Art Institute of Chicago, and the students had to walk through the Art Institute to get to the art school. So they were absorbing and sort of reconfiguring and all their these extraordinary broad range of art historic references. And that idea of what references they brought into their work really led to the very distinct aesthetic that they came up with. So a lot of their work is very graphic. It's very influenced by comic books, by the vernacular culture that surrounded them in Chicago, by non-Western art, by so-called outsider artists that they used to visit when they were living in the city, by the kind of sideshow culture. They had a real love of vernacular culture and incorporated that into their work in extremely fun and playful ways.
Yeah, and I'd add as well that one of the things that was very important to look at and highlight around these artists is not only the art school they went to, but there were a particular number of teachers who were very influential and very important. And almost in Chicago, there's this kind of a line, a history of art teachers who all taught each other and kind of climaxed at this amazing moment. And one of them, Ray Yoshida, is actually in the exhibition because he was quite close to their age, really, and ended up being very influenced by them in turn. But as a large group of artists, as Rosie's mentioned, they weren't all there at the same time. When four of them came for the opening of the exhibition, and they talked about how some of them crossed over and some of them didn't really even know each other so well, but they were very influential on each other. And of course, with any group of artists like this, there's close relationships, friendships, marriages in their case, and also, of course, frictions and dislikes. So, yeah. You know, it's interesting to follow a group of artists like this and look at their work and try and draw some of those connections, whether visual or otherwise, out.
Certainly in the exhibition, you do get the sense of this group as a kind of community, although it's interesting to hear that they weren't necessarily so close. But there's that amazing painting of the kind of a space, and it's four different iterations. It's the Roger Brown, right? And you can see that it's like their parties kind of unfolding. And the other things that really stood out, well, so much, but some of it was the kind of collaborative drawings that they would do only really as promotional materials for their exhibitions. But it definitely seemed like they were kind of sharing a creative energy.
For sure.
And that energy was something that we really wanted to try and capture within the exhibition. You're right to point out that there were moments where they collaborated, but when Sarah and I went to Chicago the first time, we were really expecting or hoping, probably hoping to find exquisite corpses that they'd all done together, much more sort of collaborative work, but actually it's not there. And when we met with Jim Nutt and Gladys Nielsen, they were really keen to point out that this fantasy of collaboration comes from the way that the story of this group of artists has been told inaccurately. So, for example, there's the idea that they all went to art school at the same time. And of course, that's not true. As soon as you look at the details, you realise that they're not. So those moments of collective endeavour, which are manifest also in the way that they made their exhibitions and these amazing sort of comic book catalogues, they're there and they point towards an energy, but they're not always, these artists are not always collaborative in the way that we'd expected them
the way
to
that we'd
be.
Completely idealised.
Yes.
Slightly fetishised.
Exactly.
We thought we'd find all these great works of them, or, you know, seeing the hand of three different artists. And actually, there are a couple of examples, but mostly the publications you're mentioning where they made work together, they were very cheap $1 comics they made as a way of marketing their exhibitions, and because, of course, they couldn't afford to make catalogues. So those, but they, I suppose those publications also reveal the kind of joy and the moment of fun that's within all of their work. And then independently, of course, they consider their practices very serious, regardless of the lightness sometimes of the methodology or the way that, you know, the kind of forms they used. But yeah, the comics are really kind of the only moment where they work together. Mm.
I mean, the humour is something that really stood out for me. I'm always up for seeing some art that's gonna make me laugh a bit as well as make me think. And it really struck me. Tell me about your trip, your research trip to Chicago, because these guys were so rooted in their, you know, they're the Chicago Imagists. They were from Chicago. That's where this kind of movement happened.
Yeah.
What's their legacy like there now? You go over, you know, can you see their influence in different corners?
You can see it in a lot of places, but of course, like any group of artists from a city, you have generations who basically make work that moves away from the previous generations. And then in a way, maybe us wanting to show this now is another sign of it coming full circle. I mean, that themselves, they were reacting, the group of artists, the generation before them, were still post-war very influenced by a darkness and, you know, very directly a lot of the artists who taught them, you know, their work was still about war and still about death. And you can see in their work, it's a shift away. So I think the generations after them also moved away from the kind of work they made. But now it's come full circle. And there are artists in There are artists in Chicago who are directly influenced. There are artists in Chicago who are directly almost plagiarizing their work.
Yeah.
But there's also still a lot of love and a lot of joy for them. And there's just been a major exhibition of the Hairy Who. So that was the core group of them. And they recreated recently in Chicago those exhibitions as a historical show. So again, there's a lot of people looking at that work now, I think internationally, but hasn't been shown in the UK since 1980. So it's kind of a moment.
The other interesting thing that the four artists who joined us during the opening of the exhibition, Art Green, Gladys Nielsen, Sarah Canwright and...
Sue Ellen Rocker.
Yes. That they said was that, because we were asking them about the city of Chicago and what it meant to them and what it meant in their work. And of course, there's the vernacular culture that surrounded the city. There's the kind of grittiness of Chicago blues music. But they also said that they weren't the ambitious ones. They were the ones who stayed in Chicago. They were the ones who stayed in the city. And I think that was really interesting and quite enlightening and surprising to us. And I think one of the appeals is that for us is just sort of what you can do as a group together in a particular place, absorbing the very particular references that are in that situation that are around you and creating a new type of aesthetic that comes out of that.
Rosie, I'd like to ask, sort of, to start to wrap it up. We were chatting before we came on air about how this visual language that the Chicago Imagists have kind of pioneered has come back a bit, and we've just touched on that. I feel like this sort of imagery today is a bit more prevalent in illustration, and I wondered a bit about your reflections on the kind of shift on how this graphic style has kind of been maintained, if it has been maintained in quote unquote visual art. Mm. And if so, who's working in a kind of, so who's kind of picking, taking up the baton of the Chicago Imagists today, would you say?
It's a good question.
It's quite a tough question.
It's quite a tough question because I think it's also not just about the graphic element of it, which I think you could definitely trace through illustration in a more formal way. But I think it's the playfulness. I think it's the interest in the figure as an interesting subject matter. I think for a long time, figurative art, a bit like surrealism, was just not seen as a particularly productive angle. And I think that's definitely come back. Mm. And that sort of playful jokiness in, you know, I'm thinking of people like Anya Kantorovsky, Alison Katz, Jana Euler. Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
This group of painters who were, you know, roughly affiliated with each other as well, actually, who were looking again at the surreal, I guess. Mm. I mean, that's a very easy way to talk about it.
I think
it's
about some of it isn't directly about drawing the aesthetic values of the work, maybe, but a kind of shared sensibility.
Yes.
And you mentioned the humour as well. I think picking up on, you know, one of the things that we had a lot of fun with is the Chicago Imagists titles of their works, particularly Carl Wersum and Jim Nutt, are really hilarious and sometimes terrible, like kind of almost dad puns that we really enjoyed. And Carl's consistently hilarious titling that we, you know, that sense of humour drawn through the work, where sometimes they were dealing with really tough subject matter. The way that they were dealing with those, with that language, is almost, I think, the thing that's come through is a sensibility, a shared sensibility that we're seeing in a lot of artists' work. So plucking it directly is quite difficult in a way. It is a tough question. I mean, so many people, the reason why I love the Chicago Images so much was finding out about them through Mike Kelly, who I absolutely love. I've managed to use this as an excuse to crowbar a Mike Kelly film into the exhibition, which is, you know, he was very influenced by them and wrote about them. But for me, again, there's a lineage of people over time who've picked up and drawn aspects of their work. Drawn from aspects of their work, I should say.
I mean, Jeff Koons is a massive Ed Paschke fan and used to be Ed Paschke's assistant.
Yeah.
And there is a generation of artists who were taught by them, because many of them went on to be teachers themselves.
And still are.
And still are, exactly, yeah. So there's a whole lineage of artists who went through a similar education to them, at, you know, with them as teachers. So it's huge, but I think a lot of it is about a sensibility rather than a formal direct lifting from.
Thank you, Sarah McQuarrie and Rosie Cooper. And How Chicago, Imagists 1960s and 70s will be on at Goldsmith CCA until the 26th of May this year. If you miss it, then you can catch it later, courtesy of the South Bank Centre's Hayward Touring, as it travels to Delaware Pavilion from the 15th of June to the 8th of September. You're with the Monocle Weekly. I enjoyed that. Did you?
I did. I had a wonderful time. Nice being in the studio with you all, and some great bookings there. Sarah, the last thing, it's particularly nice hearing you with Sarah and Rosie. That's a great new space, isn't it? It's went down and interviewed them there and then in the gallery.
Actually, they came up here, but it is amazing, that space. I hadn't seen it yet. I know that it opened with an Ivor Cutler exhibition that I was really sorry to miss.
Yeah, all sorts of stuff in there.
But this one's great. If you haven't seen it, I know it's your neck of the woods.
It's my neck of the woods.
Head down.
Spitting distance of cars abound.
Lovely also to talk to David. I know that we see a lot of these crazy kind of numbers everywhere.
Yeah.
Fake news almost.
Yeah.
Just the wrong spin. And as he says, you know, you've got to unpack it a bit, go a little bit deeper.
It was a fascinating talk with David Spiegelhalter. Did you want to be his friend? You kind of want someone like that in your armoury, don't you? You can pull out. I don't mean on pub quizzes. I mean just generally.
That's it this week, Rob. It was 510.
510 editions of the Monocle Weekly Down.
Today's show was produced by myself and Tom Hall. Our studio manager was Maylie Evans. We'll be back, as always, next week. But for now, it's goodbye from me, Augusta Macellari.
It's goodbye from me, Robert Bound.
Goodbye.